Welcome to the Good Hard Story Podcast, where we believe that the good story and the hard story can be the exact same story. I'm Catherine Wolf, and I'm a stroke survivor, a speaker, an author, and co-founder of Hope Heals. Tune in here every week for conversations about wholeheartedly living in a good hard story. Join me in this joyful rebellion to the darkness where we discover the treasures hidden in our hurting. Hello, friends. Thank you for tuning in to the Good Hard Story Podcast today. Today is very special because today is Ask Amy Julia Day. I have named a regular series here at the Good Hard Story Podcast, Ask Amy Julia, because Amy Julia Becker is our resident disability theologian. She majorly informs so much of our thinking at Hope Heals on all issues concerning disability and just belonging, creating these sacred spaces of belovedness and belonging, and really so much of where there is so much intersection in faith and just the disability community. And anyway, Amy Julia Becker is a brilliant thinker person. And so these Ask Amy Julias deserved a little series song. So Ask Amy Julia, Ask Amy Julia. Here at Good Heart Story Podcast, we ask Amy Julia. What do you think? Pretty incredible, right?
Oh my goodness. Catherine, are you going to do that every time? That's my favorite thing ever.
Every time. I used to be really, really embarrassed that I have this terrible voice now. And I somehow like really got over it. And I'm like, it is so bad. It's not the right word at all I would use anymore. It is so funky and strange that it merits lots of weird songs because it's just kind of funny. So I hope you're here for it. I am Amy Julia, and I want to jump in and just allow you to say hey if you want to.
Oh my gosh, I'm so here for it, and I'm so honored. I don't think I've ever had anyone like write a song for me about me, whatever you want to call that. So thank you, and I'm dead serious when I say that. I really appreciate it. And I'm so excited to be here and to be. I will say, I think we are in a mutual relationship of informing each other. And, you know, in some ways, I can get so lost in like thinking and books and abstraction. And I think Hope Heals very much brings me back to lived experience and connecting the thinking to the living. And I love that so much. And so, you know, maybe I get to offer a little bit of that thinking into some people's lived experiences, and that would be awesome too. But I'm just really, really glad to be here. Thank you. And yeah, thank you for my song.
Oh my goodness. Well, listen, I'm a huge fan of the Holy Post podcast, and I wanted to jump in today by telling our listeners that Amy Julia is a prolific writer. Her pieces, her thoughts, her insights are featured in everything from New York Times to Time Magazine to The Atlantic. And I really wanted to focus our time today on a recent piece that she wrote for Time Magazine entitled Doctors Don't Know How to Talk About Down Syndrome, that I thought was chilling. I mean, brilliant, moving, and so articulate, and just such a powerful lived experience piece. Well, it just really blew me away. And I'd love, I'd love to in the show notes, we'll definitely link to the piece. And Amy Julia, wow. Of course, I was in tears after reading it for the first time, but went back for a second and third, just overwhelmed at who could not agree with you after reading this? Who could not land where you do after reading your lived experience with Penny? But in general, why don't you give just, if you haven't read the article, kind of a 1-minute synopsis, because I definitely could, but you would better than I would, let's be honest.
Sure. Well, so, you know, many people in the Down syndrome community for years have talked about how whether they got a prenatal diagnosis of Down syndrome or like we did a postnatal, you know, once your child is born, got a diagnosis of Down syndrome and how those experiences, I mean, some people would use the words traumatic, others would just say it was really bad because the doctors were essentially bringing a bias against people with Down syndrome into that conversation. And so also for many years, the, you know, industry groups around Down syndrome and disability, as well as even medical groups would say, the way you deliver a diagnosis should be informed, accurate, up to date. So you're not using information from 50 years ago, and you're not using language like, I'm sorry, or I have bad news, but you are saying, you know, here's a condition that we think or know that your, you know, fetus or baby has, and we want to tell you some of the implications. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that a doctor ideally would both provide some medical context for that. Like, here are some of the concerns that we have from a medical perspective when it comes to a condition like Down syndrome, but that they'd also give some sense of the social reality and the educational opportunities and what life might look like outside of a hospital when it comes to Down syndrome. And that often doesn't happen. So I think a lot of us who are in the Down syndrome community have known that this is a problem for a really long time, but this is the first time that I know of that a study has actually interviewed a wide cross-section of people. I think it was about 250 or 300 people over the course of 5 years across most of the United States, I think 40 different states, to ask about those experiences. And they found that in the majority of cases, doctors did bring a bias into those conversations. Mm-hmm. And so this was my essay was really in response to that study and those findings, and trying to talk about why it matters so much that we don't only talk about Down syndrome in terms of hardships or risks or chances of medical, you know, mishaps, but actually talk about the fullness of life that includes some hard things when it comes to having Down syndrome.
Wow. It is so compelling. So many questions. The story of when you and your family hosted the young doctors in your home, and one of the doctors earlier in the day before having to come to your house for dinner as part of a medical class or something, said like there could be nothing worse than having Down syndrome child or something.
Yeah.
And afterwards him saying, I wish I were in this family or whatever. I'm majorly paraphrasing, but that just, it choked me up so much. Of course, it's the experience of meeting someone, looking them in the eye, proximity always lessens bias. Oh my goodness.
Yeah, I think that's so true. Proximity. And also what I've realized with doctors in particular, and Catherine, I'm curious to hear about your experience of this, because after I wrote the time piece, I had a number of people who have chronic illness or other types of disability who said, doctors don't know how to talk about me either. You know, like this is not just about Down syndrome.
Yes.
But in what I think is also true is one of my friends who's a pediatrician, when we talked about this a long time ago, said, you know, the only kids who I've seen with Down syndrome are in the hospital. And as a result, I think of all people with Down syndrome as literally having something going on in their bodies that requires them to be in the hospital. Mm-hmm. Even though he's like, I obviously see lots of typical kids in the hospital, but I have enough experience outside of the hospital with kids who aren't in the hospital that I don't think that being a kid means you're in the hospital. But I do think being a person with Down syndrome essentially means you're in the hospital. And so my point just being like seeing whether it's our daughter Penny or, you know, you in your home, it gives a very different impression of what it means to live in a body that has had a stroke or what it means to live in a body that has a third copy of the 21st chromosome. And being able to see the social reality and not just the medical reality expands the view of the person so much. And again, I think expands the imagination for what's possible. And what does it mean to live a good life, right? That it doesn't have to mean a certain IQ, or even that certain aspects of our bodies look a certain way, perform a certain way, achieve a certain way. And I think for those doctors, those medical students, it was truly a transformational experience. Essentially to spend, I mean, Penny was so little, she went to bed in the middle of dinner. So it's like they got an hour with Penny, probably another hour talking to us, and it completely reshaped their view of Down syndrome, because they were like, I truly did not believe this was possible, that right. You could have a three-year-old with Down syndrome who would, you know, wave hello and do all the things that kids do, and not, you know, she had plenty of disabilities in the midst of that, but it was still just this like, yeah, I could see that being my family and I would like it. And it's so important.
Exactly. I, from start to finish with my ordeal, have thought so much about all of these issues. I have often thought, if technology would have permitted it, would doctors have seen that in my mother's womb, I had an AVM in my brain, and what would my parents have been told to do? Would they have been told to terminate the pregnancy because she's got a fatal AVM in her brain? I don't know. That could be slightly salacious, but honestly, I think it could be the reality. It's not outside of the reality for sure. And even now, if all you knew was that a girl nearly died, can't walk, can't drive, has ongoing massive health problems, blah, 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 you could think she's not really doing well in life, or she's not really, you know what I mean? Like,
yes,
surely she doesn't have a full life. Mm-hmm. And nothing could be further from the truth. So I just think until you really get to know someone specifically, it's ridiculous to make blanket statements about worthiness. And I'm so fascinated with this notion of the ideal, like the ideal doesn't have an extra chromosome, or the ideal doesn't have any disabilities whatsoever. Right. And for both Penny and I, and for all of our brothers and sisters in similar situations, that's not remotely true, that we all have worth because we're here. If we weren't supposed to be here, we wouldn't be here. So it's so ludicrous to assign worth based on how well your body functions or how well you can process information, or none of that is what makes us people, I don't believe.
And I also think back, I remember I read in this book by Brian Brock, it's called Wondrously Wounded. I may have mentioned it here before, but one of the things he writes about is how the early Christian theologians said, you know, the things that we value in other humans, appearance, strength, intelligence, are actually quite clearly not what God values. Like, that is scripturally not what God values. Like, he says, my value is not in the strength of the horse, you know, but it's in the heart, and it's in how you treat. I mean, Jesus being like, yeah, pretty much the only thing that matters is how you treat the people who are lower than you on the status scale, right? Like, and that, where am I going to identify so closely that, like, the only place you can find me is with the people who are, you know, poor and in prison and ill and unclothed, right? Like, so there is a sense in which it's not, it's almost even beyond what you just said, which is, it's not this sense of, oh, let's stop using the athletic, thin, you know, conventionally beautiful, intelligent person as our standard. It's like, that actually is distorting us from understanding God's standard, which is not to say that, like, some, you know, beautiful, athletic, intelligent person couldn't be godly. It's to say that, you know, I mean, it's like a very, it almost sounds trite, but, like, God does look at the heart. That is actually what matters to God. And honestly, what matters to each of us in our relations with one another too.
So, absolutely.
You know, there's just,
you have not said this before here, and it is striking. I mean, yeah, of course. And yet everything in our world is saying the absolute opposite of that. And
yes.
Of course, that's where doctors, even 20 years after your, after Penny's birth, are basically saying the same things, like, I'm so sorry. Instead of, this is a neutral that she has Down syndrome.
Yep.
This is definitely just another thing about who she is. Like, how dare you? I'm so mad that there's doctors on your path.
Oh, gosh, I know. And yet I also feel for them because their training in so many ways, not just their medical training, but even just the system we have in America in which we say, because you are highly intelligent when it comes to like learning information, we are going to reward you with prestige and money. And we're going to tell you to work harder and prove your worth that way. And it seems to be working for you. And you just keep going, keep going, keep going. And so the thought of someone who could never learn from a book the things that a doctor knows and could never perform a surgery and could never, I mean, I think there really is a sense of like, well, how can you have a life that's worth living? And obviously, I think they're absolutely wrong in that perception. But I do also think that we all, our society contributes to that in a lot of ways. But I also will say the other thing that was really helpful for me in that book was like the ancient Greek and Roman ideal of the human was very similar to what we now say is an ideal human in terms of like muscles and intelligence and power and, you know, money and all those things. Like, this isn't new. And yet God's like, view of us is what, like, that's what it means to start to learn how to see the way Jesus sees. It's like a different type of beauty. It's a different type of strength. And I think the Beatitudes, 1 Corinthians 13, like these different places really can help us start to receive God's view of other people, which actually then starts helping us receive God's view of ourselves, not as like machines who need to perform in order to prove ourselves, but as like beloved ones who don't need to do anything to earn our worth and get to receive and give love. And that's
right. Wow. That is really powerful. I'm so fascinated by these thoughts about doctors who really, I mean, it's so complicated. I'm so grateful for all the medical care I've received, all the doctors through all the years, through all the surgeries, all the specialties. However, many medical professionals did the opposite of instill hope in me and my family throughout and were proven wrong many times.
Yeah.
And that is also very striking in conversations about medical professionals because we, as the patients, treat them like they have all the answers and it stops there. But as my challenger husband has frequently narrated, it is the practice of medicine. Practice. They're practicing. They don't know. They're not God. And I just think that's been a real paradigm shifter for me is, doctors are amazing, but doctors don't always know. And I just think that's really important to just refocus how we think. Like, why do they get the final word of my story? Why do they get to say, I'm so sorry, you know, your daughter's life is less worthy than the able-bodied baby next room over? That's just so ridiculous and tragic. And yeah, people like you here on Ask Amy Julia can be the ones to really transform culture in those realms. I am so touched by your recent writing and posting about Penny going to homecoming. It just, I mean, it lit me up seeing the pictures of that sweet 18-year-old at homecoming having a blast. And in light of reading these words and looking at those pictures from homecoming, I just, I mean, I was overwhelmed. Like, I hope the doctor in the hospital room that day telling you I'm sorry somehow stumbles upon a picture of Penny at her senior homecoming, laughing and smiling and clearly loving her life. And are you still sorry, doctor? Yeah, you're still sorry. I wanted in moments throughout my ordeal, especially when I was sending out birth announcements after baby John was born, to send the birth announcement to certain doctors who acted as though Catherine's life is basically over now. She will never do blank, 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 blank again. And I wanted to send Christmas cards as well.
I did.
Oh, you did?
I'm not even kidding. I did. I put them on our Christmas card list because I felt like it was really important. Because I don't know if you had this in your pediatrician's office, but they're like all the Christmas cards from the different patients who send their Christmas cards.
And I was
like, we are sending our Christmas cards. They are going to, like, it seems so important to me. This is actually why I started blogging and am on like Facebook and Instagram. It did not start off as like, maybe I'll, you know, have an audience of people who will read my books. It was just like, if people need to literally see images of our family that are not medicalized. Like that are just of us being a family, and not to put like, obviously there's a glossy spin that comes, whether it's a Christmas card or an Instagram post, but there's also a sense of, yeah, we're just a family being a family and we have a child with Down syndrome. And the image of that really, really matters. And I think your family is doing the same thing in terms of, yeah, I'm a mom. Sure. I use a wheelchair sometimes and I'm a mom. Like, let's just expand the understanding of identity that does not dismiss the disability aspect of it, but also does not reduce any of us to a diagnosis or to a set of limitations, even though those limitations can be very real.
Right. Oh, goodness. You have inspired me to now start sending Christmas cards to my children's pediatricians because they do display them in the office.
Yes.
And for me, there are very, very few mothers that are wheelchair users that are out much in the world, like young moms with a second grader, especially. Yep. And they're out there. They're just not showcased. You know, they're not in the world out there as much. So I need to do all I can. And yes, I am doing a lot through social media, but I need to send pictures a lot of places of this mom in the wheelchair still has a life and is raising her own children. And it just seems preposterous that we need to remind the world that we exist, but evidently I feel like we do, especially probably to the medical community who are further narrating to future patients very just dark realities. It's a tragedy. I was very struck in how you have not seen the needle shift much even in the last two decades and found that very disturbing with the amount of new technology and just increased access to information. Didn't you write in that article that life expectancy has doubled for people living with Down syndrome in the last two decades?
Well, it has doubled in my lifetime.
In your lifetime, I don't know exactly.
Yeah, because basically in the 80s, there's a pretty common heart defect for babies with Down syndrome that used to be fatal around between the age of like 20 and 25. Mm-hmm. And now that is like a pretty easy fix. Like it's just one of those.
I mean, that needs to be like plastered on every like pediatrician's or whoever, obstetricians, whatever, the hospital rooms all over that in the last, let's say, I don't want to say your age if you don't want me to, but a little more than a few decades, that life expectancy has doubled.
So there's also this corresponding fear for parents that is that their children with Down syndrome will outlive them. So in other words, now that people with Down syndrome are living into their 60s and sometimes 70s, parents are saying, well, gosh, who's going to be present for them after I die?
Right.
And I actually had a conversation with a woman just last year who said, I really want my baby who has been prenatally diagnosed with Down syndrome. And I feel like it is my responsibility not to bring her into the world because I will probably die before she does. And I don't know that anyone will be there to take care of her. And I don't know what her capabilities will be. And I would gladly be with her for the rest of my life. But what happens after I die? And there are, I think, some wrong assumptions embedded in that. But I also feel like until we have a society that says we actually want to care for one another, even when we, quote unquote, you know, become, have needs, right? Even when we have needs for care.
I wanted to add what to me is just ridiculous in those realms. I have tremendous, just empathy for that mother. I also want to say to her, but do you realize any child without a chromosome difference, it's kind of the same thing. You'll likely outlive them. What about the mother who has an alcoholic child? What about the mother who has a child with bipolar? What about the mother who has a child with literally anything that is going to require care by somebody in their life? I mean, that's really all of us, if we're honest. So I think that assumption is just extra tragic that society's kind of teeter up to think it's all on me to care for my child, and thus I must not bring her into the world. I mean,
yeah, I agree. Well, it's like this series of different assumptions that are tragic. But it also, I think, again, demonstrates some of the problems that we have as a society thinking about disability, not as like a problem to be either fixed, or if it can't be fixed, then eliminated, right? I mean, and as opposed to thinking about disability as a visible manifestation of our humanity, which is we are people who are vulnerable and limited, and there is brokenness in our bodies and our minds. And that is like absolutely true of all of us. And it shows up in ways that are more visible in some of us than others. Right. But what that could call forth is like this other aspect of our humanity, which is love and care and mutual giving and receiving, as opposed to, oh no, I don't want anything to do with that, which is what we essentially see, whether that's like the number of people with, you know, mental health problems who are imprisoned, the number of children with disabilities, you know, who are institutionalized or set apart from their typical peers in educational settings, the number of people, you know, who are making choices when it comes to terminating pregnancies. There's all of that where it's like, we don't know what to do with disability, so we're just going to push it to the side, which I think in some ways is saying like, we don't know what to do with the fact that we are humans. And that we don't control our destiny. We don't.
But so good. Yeah.
So scary.
Yeah.
So I think like receiving disability is like actually receiving humanity. And it's really hard for us to do that.
I think you're so right. It's tragic. Amy Julia, as you close your article, I just wanted to read this quote that struck me so much. You write, Penny challenges me to pay more attention to people instead of tasks, to laugh instead of curse when I make a mistake, and to value mutuality more than self-sufficiency. She has different capacities when it comes to learning, but she has no limits on her capacity to love or to live a full life. Well, that's just so just beautifully put. I, as I was reading it, I was thinking back just this past weekend, my son, Jimmy, formerly known as James, spoke at a conference with me, and he was talking to the teenagers at this conference with their parents that I was speaking to, and he, out of the gate, we don't know where this came from, said, because they'd wanted him to speak on being a child of a mother with disabilities. Hmm. And he said that one of the things that he has learned is to slow down in life and to be present to the moment right in front of him. And what he didn't say is, because I have no choice, because my mom walks so slow and it takes so long to get her in the car, and I'm charged with helping her. I'm hand and foot by my dad to do life. He didn't say any of that, but that was the subtext. But there was something so beautiful, even in a child's brain, being able to recognize the gift of disability. It was very striking. And as I read that, a mother recognizing that in their child with intellectual disabilities is also stunning, that disability can be teachers for our family. They are teaching deep truths to friends and family alike if we have eyes to see it. And it's glorious. I am so grateful for how you then are teaching the world through gorgeous pieces like this, all the truths you're learning.
Thank you so much. And yeah, I think Jimmy and I have some things in common, although I had not learned that by the time I was 15, that there is actually some like beauty in slowing down and in and in just, again, like kind of recognizing there's a humanity there. And there's so much that we miss by being busy. I'll say one thing here. I had a vision this past summer of walking on kind of the path of life. And I wanted very much to have the highway. Like I wanted my path to be fast and secure and really clear. Like this is exactly where we go. And I was so struck by the fact of like how boring and manufactured the highway is, you know? And I'm like, wait, but I'd actually so much rather like hike up a mountain or, you know, wander down the beach where the path is not clear and it does take longer and it's so much more beautiful and I can do it with other people. And I think that is this sense of like, wait, what do we really value? Like, what do we, at the end of the day, what do we really want our lives to be about? Do we want it to be about efficiency and getting things done? Or do we want it to be about loving one another? And I know it sounds kind of cheesy, but I really do want it to be about loving one another. I want my life to be about that. And Penny has helped to make that like a much deeper and broader reality for us, I think.
I have the privilege of knowing that sweet Penny for multiple years now, and I can attest what a gift to my life to know her. I mean that. She is and the whole Becker family, I might add, is pretty exceptional human beings, and my life is so much better for knowing you. Amy Julia, I like to close the Good Heart Story podcast by asking two questions. And feel free to not answer right away if I'm surprising you too much. I wanted to ask, Amy Julia, what is good in your story? What is hard in your story? And how do you live in the tension of both of those in your Good Heart Story? Because here at Hope Heals, we believe the good story and the hard story can be the exact same story.
Well, I am a regular listener of the Good Heart Story podcast, so I knew that question was coming.
Oh, yeah.
Doesn't mean I have a great answer, but I should. And, you know, what comes to mind for me is that one of the things that I feel like I've really been seeing recently is that I can live into a story of not being enough. And I can interpret the world according to that story. And I'm starting to notice when I do that. So that's hard for me when I feel like I'm not enough, whether that's like my, you know, I don't look good enough, or I didn't get that enough done, or I didn't do that well enough. I mean, enough. I get that a lot. And so there's a hardship to that. But what's been really good is starting to recognize that. And it's not even that it's untrue. Like there are times where I mess it up and like it's not enough on this like surface level. And yet asking the question of whether there's a deeper truth to who I am and to what God is doing in my life and to the reality of, yeah, like I am not someone who like has really cool clothes. Like I'm, you know, so that's an area of insecurity for me where I'm like not enough at the cocktail party. And it's like, you know what? And on some level, that's true. And there's also usually someone at that cocktail party who feels comfortable enough with me to like share something that's like deep and true about their life. And I'm incredibly grateful for it and enriched by it. And on some level, that's because of that surface area where I'm not enough. Does that make sense? And so there's like yes. a real goodness to it. And so that's, anyway, that we're in the midst of transition. We're moving. My husband has a new job. I'm meeting lots of new people. So that insecurity about like not being enough comes up all the time right now. And I'm really trying to identify each one of those like pings of not being enough and bringing it to God and saying like, okay, what's the deeper story? Like, what is it that I need to know is true about me in front of you? And I will say, I didn't even think of this when I started saying this as my answer. When I was at Hope Heals Camp this summer, and I lifted up my plate on the last night of camp, which is when there's a word underneath.
I think I know where you're going.
Guess what word it was?
Yep.
It was enough. And yep. And I really carried that sense of like, what does it mean to believe that God has given me enough, that I am enough, that that there is real beauty even in the places where I feel like there's not enough, you know? So that's the area where I am trying to live out the good, hard story right now.
Wow, that's incredibly poignant. I feel the opposite pretty much all the time. I feel like I'm too much. So, I mean, I probably also feel like I'm not enough, but I feel like I'm too much at the same time. Mm-hmm. So I'm right there with you, but I want to lift up my plate and see never too much.
Never too much.
Just enough.
There you go.
And right there with you, sister. Thank you for being so vulnerable. I love that we get to do this. I can't believe that this incredible disability theologian is doing a regular series on the Good Hard Story podcast. And as I continue to perform the song around the house and the tune catches on and my kids start singing it, we will think of you as we chant, Ask Amy Julia, Ask Amy Julia, until it's a thing. So get ready. It's going to
happen. I would like some three-part harmony next time, please.
Oh, absolutely. It's coming. It's coming okay. for sure. Good. Anyway, Amy Julia, thank you always for your just tremendous insights, research, storytelling, just all you bring to every conversation we get to have. It is such a joy to learn from you.
Thank you, Catherine. It is quite a joy to be here with you, too.
Thank you for joining us on the Good Hard Story podcast. To learn more about what we are doing, follow us on Instagram at Hope Heals. Check out all things Hope Heals at hopeheals.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this wherever you get podcasts, and please feel free to share this episode with somebody who needs to hear it. Good Hard Story Podcast is a production of Good Hard Story, LLC. It is produced by Leah Case and Mary Austin Hall. And I am your fearless and fabulous host, Catherine Wolf. Come back and join us every week where we believe that the good story and the hard story can be the very same story. We are with you and for you, friend.